Chapter 10, An Unreal War. In Miami, Burr sat at his small grey desk in the office he shared with Strelsky and thought about Operation Limpet. Everything was going well. Everyone said so. Strelsky thought it, and so did Goodhue, who phoned him every day from London. "The people at the top agree that Limpet is very important," Goodhue had told him this morning.
"Which people at the top?" asked Burr.
"My minister. He saw your list," said Goodhue.
"Which list?" asked Burr.
"The one that your source photographed," said Goodhue. "The list of people who are doing deals with Roper. Just the names and numbers, not the actual photograph, of course. Roper will think we stole the list from his post or heard it in a telephone call."
"Roper didn't put that list in a letter," shouted Burr. "He didn't say it over the phone. He wrote it on a piece of paper, and our source took a photograph of it. Roper will know immediately where those names and numbers come from."
"Don't shout at me, Leonard," replied Goodhue. "My minister is shocked and unhappy about the corruption, can't you see? And I work for this man, so I have to tell him how we are doing. He wants to have lunch with me on Thursday to tell me some important news. I thought you would be happy, not angry."
Burr breathed slowly.
"Yes, of course I understand, Rex," he said.
When he ended the call, he immediately rang Rook.
"Rex Goodhue must get no more limpet reports from us that we haven't checked first," Burr said. "And that's from now."
Even after that, Burr and Strelsky thought that things would be okay. But both were quietly worried when Burr asked the American government if they could stop a ship sailing out of Curaçao to Colón in Panama.
"We believe it is carrying arms worth more than $50 million, he told the government.
But the answer was no. Then Burr and Strelsky heard that Apostol had been exchanged for a lawyer called Moranti.
"Maybe things were getting too dangerous for him," Burr thought. "He's just decided to stop for a bit."
And Moranti lived in Caracas, of course, which was closer to Curaçao. But he was worried when he learned that Sir Anthony Bradshaw had called Roper from England. And after that, Strelsky got a call from the police. Strelsky left Burr in the office and immediately drove to some expensive Miami apartments called Sunglades, in a rich area where he had never been before. There were lots of police cars there.
"We heard you had some interest in this Dr. Apostol," said one of the policemen, whom Strelsky knew a little. "That's why we called you. It's bad, sir."
Long before he reached the apartment, Strelsky knew that Dr. Paul Apostol was dead. An hour later, Strelsky returned to the office with the news that Apostol had been murdered. He did not look at Burr while he was speaking. Burr knew that Strelsky was very angry and that he was thinking,
"It's your people who have killed him, and now I wish we weren't sitting in the same room."
Burr's first call was to Rook in Curaçao to tell him that Operation Limpet was in danger and that Jonathan needed to be given the signal to escape. This meant that he had to get away from Roper and his group and get to the nearest British embassy. But the call came too late. When Rook got Burr's message, he was already watching Roper's plane taking off from Curaçao on its way to Panama. Then Burr rang Goodhue in London.
Apostol was tortured before he was murdered, he said. Perhaps he told them about Jonathan. But if we get Jonathan out, we can still go after Roper. We have a lot more information about him now.
Oh, yes, well, I see, replied Goodhue in a strange voice. Yes, you mustn't stop what you're doing.
It always used to be we, Burr thought. So what was the important news from the minister? He asked.
Oh, it's good, Goodhue replied politely. They're giving me a new job managing a Whitehall watch group. It's everything we've fought for, but it means I'll have to stop what I'm doing for Operation Limpet, of course.
At that moment, another call came in from one of Burr's agents. Roper's plane had gone below the radar as it came into Panama. They had completely lost its signal.
Then where in the hell is it? Burr shouted.
Mr. Burr, sir, said a boy called Hank. It's disappeared.
On the plane, Roper told Jonathan that they were going to a mountain called Cerro Fabrega in Panama. I'm about to see what I've come for, thought Jonathan as he sat between Roper and Langbourne on the plane. Tabby and Frisky were behind them. The plane flew down towards the jungle below. After the plane, they took a helicopter back up above the jungle. Jonathan could now see the sea on one side and banana trees and a yellow road on the other. They landed in a field with men in army uniforms and carrying guns staring up at them. When the helicopter engine stopped, a small man ran towards them.
"Hi, Manny," shouted Roper. "Remember Sandy Langbourne? And this is Derek Thomas."
Five or six other rich and confident European men, who Jonathan recognised from their visits to Crystal Island, joined them, and they all followed the small man down a path. Frisky and Tabby walked at the back. The birds were singing loudly. Suddenly, Jonathan heard guns from behind the trees, followed by the sound of a missile. Then there was silence, before the birds began to sing again. They climbed for several hours under a dark, rainy sky. They walked past fast rivers and through thick jungle until they came to a large camp where there was just a cook and a few other men.
"Many soldiers were trained here," the small man said, "to fight in Panama, Nicaragua, Guatemala, and Colombia. Spanish people, Indian people, they were all trained well."
The camp was full of animals in cages. Sad tigers, silent monkeys, and birds with no wings.
"Colonel Fernandez loves animals very much," explained the small man.
The next day, they met Colonel Fernandez, a tall man with dark hair who led them to another part of the jungle. They stood above a small town that looked as if it was made of wood. There was an airfield next to the town with lots of old and broken planes in it.
"You're going to watch a battle," Tabby whispered to Jonathan.
They were taken to a camp and Jonathan sat around a table with the other guests. Young boys brought them food and drink while they watched an army plane slowly appear from the north. Suddenly, some soldiers jumped out of it in parachutes and dropped to the ground. Jonathan noticed that there were a couple of men in army uniforms shouting at the soldiers in American voices. Then, one of the tanks at the end of the field started shooting at the men with the parachutes, but the men shot back, and suddenly the tank was on fire. For the next hour, Jonathan and the others watched, amazed, as a huge battle was held in the wooden town in front of them. All kinds of guns and missiles were used to destroy the buildings. Finally, a very large passenger plane appeared.
"Is it part of the show?" thought Jonathan. "Or is it the CIA?"
Roper laughed when he saw Jonathan's face.
"The Russians stole it from an airport," he said. "But a computer is flying it now."
Suddenly, a missile was shot into the air and the plane became a ball of fire before disappearing into the jungle. A huge cloud of smoke came up from the trees. As all the men around the table watched with their mouths open, Jonathan carefully took $200 American from Tabby's pocket and put it in his own. Tabby did not notice that the money was gone.